blenders, and welcome to episode number 112 of Real Blend, a podcast that thinks the mayor is more of a villain than the shark.
No,
my name is Sean.
No, don't
O'Connell.
Do this. Don't start the show this way.
I am the managing director of Cinema Blend, and we have a very exciting episode of Real Blend.
Not anymore.
Planned for you. Unfortunately, more major delays from the Hollywood studios, which we will get into, and a guest we have this week. She's the director of an amazing documentary that is featured on The Rise of Skywalker, Blu-ray and DVD, which hopefully people were able to pick up. Her name is Debs Patterson, and some fantastic stories from the production of Star Wars Episode 9, and just some really good legacy stories in general. So her interview is coming up. Again, as I mentioned, I'm Sean O'Connell. Joining me this week on Real Blend, as always, from Washington, D.C., it is Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5. Hi, Kev.
Sean O'Connell, how are you, sir? And yes, the mayor is the villain in Jaws.
No,
great to talk to you,
no,
sir.
No, because here's the thing.
Guy, get
the
it out of your
system. The shark is not just being a shark. Sharks don't behave that way. And the movie incorrectly changed people's perceptions of sharks in an incorrect manner that the author, Peter Benchley, even came out and regretted how much the movie changed people's perception of what sharks are and what they could do because the movie portrayed the shark as a villain. You can't make this argument of, oh, it's just being a shark. It wasn't. When have you ever seen a video of a shark leaping onto a boat and chomping after a guy?
Shark Week. I watched Shark Week.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
And that goes to the exact... So this was a question that got raised in the tweets about this. Doctor or Frankenstein? Frankenstein
would be considered the... They're two different movies.
No, it's not. Frankenstein.
No one created... Then you're saying like, oh, is it God or the shark? Who's the villain?
The shark's mom. Is the shark's
the
mom
shark's
the villain?
Yeah.
Maybe the shark was raised poorly.
Mama shark.
I feel like the argument of like the mayor is the villain is the argument that people make to try to sound like they're like a more cerebral movie watcher. It's the fucking shark.
No, it's not.
Spielberg would tell you it's the shark.
I bet you he wouldn't.
The other voice you're hearing is Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, handsome. How are you doing?
Oh, fuck off.
A reminder that if you are enjoying conversations like this, you can head over to our Facebook community page and weigh in. Actually, someone do me a favor on that page. I know you guys are all listening. Make a poll. I want to hear a poll for Jaws. Who is the real villain of Jaws? First option, the mayor. Second option, the shark. Third option, Jake Hamilton. Fourth option, other. And then you can weigh in with what your creative things for other.
Here's the exact argument as to why the shark isn't the villain.
But you guys didn't respond to my argument. You didn't respond to my argument that the shark is not being a shark.
Okay. Wait. You know the shark's mentality that it was there to kill people, for sure?
No,
you
know, I know that sharks don't do the fucking thing that the shark does in Jaws, so much so that it caused people in the 70s to go out and kill sharks, and Peter Benchley said, I regret doing this, I regret writing this story, because it has incorrectly changed people's perception of what sharks are in real life. Therefore,
that's an opinion.
It's not an opinion, he's a fucking like scientist.
He was the leader
of shark conservation post Jaws because of what Jaws did to people's perception
of
sharks.
In Sharknado, is the shark the villain or the tornado?
Oh my god.
It's a great question.
I cannot believe that this was such a casual conversation that came up today because I did a top five best villains list on air and it fucking snowballed into this.
Here's what I'm gonna say.
Kev, wrap
only
us
thing
up.
I want to
no,
say about
those
it
two
is
two things have point. Never happened to the set. Kevin and wrap us up. When has that ever happened in the history of the show?
The mayor let people back in the water. He's the villain. No
That's
question.
True.
People
That's a
could
good point.
More less people would have died.
If you take the mayor out of the picture, the shark is still killing people.
Less people would have died if the mayor closed the beach.
Fact.
He's the villain because
he would have just gone to a different town.
The mayor wanted money. And he wanted tourism. That is a villain. That is an ill-intentioned character that led to the death of people. The shark was in its own territory, and humans were in its territory. Shark,
we
not the
are
villain.
Now posting full episodes on Cinema Blend's YouTube page. So if you'd rather stream the show over there, head to youtube.com/cinemablend and you can subscribe. I'm also going to note that if you're enjoying Westworld this season, unlike Jake Hamilton, you can watch my reaction videos.
Not good, dude.
It's different. It's definitely different. And of course, we're available everywhere podcasts can be found. But wouldn't you also argue that The Leftovers, which is a show that you made me watch, is drastically different from season one to season two? That they are completely different.
Yeah,
shows.
But like you can change and still be a good show. Like shows evolve as they realize what they are becoming. And in cases even like the first season of The Office and Leftovers, but Westworld seems to be blowing at the whims of whatever people on Reddit are screaming. And, you know, the second season feels like a course correction from the first season, and the third season feels like a course correction. It all just feels like all the writers are sitting around a table going like, well, they didn't like that, so let's try something. And I just feel like this whole futuristic, it's not Westworld at all. I mean, Leftovers is still at its core a show about people trying to come to terms with the fact that they were left behind. Westworld is literally not about Westworld anymore.
Well, I'd make an argument, but it's getting into really deep spoiler territory. Let's have that conversation off air. Kevin, you want to throw something? Okay.
Well, no, I was just going to say there's a lot of shows that you almost have to back up with an explanation prior to watching it. Like I remember with Better Call Saul, we told Jake that season one and two aren't at season three and four level. And I remember Jake, we were arguing about it one day and you're like, well, you shouldn't have to say that the first two seasons are good and then it gets better. But obviously, Leftovers did that. Apparently, I've never seen Leftovers, but apparently, that's what happened with Leftovers.
Just changes.
And
it's
The
different.
Office. Yeah, The Office, apparently. I mean, I watched season one and two of The Office, and season one is drastically different.
Yeah, but I would also argue that there's a big difference between, like, hey, dude, just get through the first six episodes of The Office, and then it clicks into gear, versus you have to watch two full seasons of a show. And granted, I'm not slighting Better Call Saul.
Right?
The first two seasons of Better Call Saul are good TV. Good TV.
Right. Yeah.
The third season is great TV. That being said, I don't think it has touched Breaking Bad yet.
Breaking Bad? Interesting.
Oh, I thought you said it was on the level of Breaking Bad.
No. It is not on the level.
Oh, wait till you see it.
Because I also feel like that is such an impossible standard. That's like telling your kid to go play basketball and then saying like, well, you're not Michael Jordan. So like I don't think for me it's ever, because I mean, you know, and
I do
trust
say
me,
that.
Yes, you do.
To my children all the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. Makes sense. And that's why they're so great.
Disappointing me. weekly poll. Okay, so I posted a weekly poll primarily because of something that Kevin and I did on Sunday, which was we tuned into a Vero stream of Zack Snyder doing an audio commentary track for his ultimate edition of Batman versus Superman. It's something he'd never done before. He wanted to do it live in the moment. Kevin was freaking out, posting shots of some of his favorite scenes from the movie with Snyder doing commentary on it. So I wanted to put in there what movie has the best director's cut. And it's clear that I have some people who follow me on social media due to the Snyder Cut book that I'm working on. And they definitely got at this poll, because Batman versus Superman earned 81% of our vote. And so I think it's skewed a little bit in that direction. But the other options were Blade Runner and Apocalypse Now. And then I got a lot of shit for not putting Lord of the Rings. So legitimately, I had no clue that there are longer versions of the Lord of the Rings movies.
Dude, like, those extended cuts are amazing. Amazing.
Why are they that much better? Why?
Well, you don't even like the original film. So like it's impossible to try to have this conversation with you.
I don't. They're eternal. Yeah.
Dude, Kevin, come on. Those are good.
So I bought all three of the extended cuts, and I watched all three of them in one weekend. It was like 16 hours or something. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it was glorious. Torture. And they're incredible. But just no, it's amazing. It's an amazing trilogy. But Sean, real quick, I just wanted to mention something about the Snyder thing. I thought that was such a cool experience. And you and I were both on it. It was very special. Like Snyder on Vero, video live commentating his Batman vs. Superman R-rated cut Ultimate Edition, which was just unbelievable. Deborah Snyder showed up at one point in the background, talked. But for me, and I mentioned this in my post about technology, to have my phone in my hand with Snyder live while on my television is the warehouse scene happening while I'm listening to Zack Snyder explain the scene to me in my AirPods while the scene's playing out on my television, was just peak geeking out. Like I was geeking out beyond belief. I remember when I was living many years ago in a townhouse with some roommates, Watchmen came out on special edition. I got the blue Dr. Manhattan Watchmen Blu-ray. And on the Blu-ray, I had never seen this before. Snyder walks out in between the screen and talks to you about the movie, like in visual form. It was unbelievable.
Cool. If you guys could have any director do that, because I thought that was really cool. I didn't watch it with you guys, but I thought it was really cool that Zack Snyder did it. If you guys could have any director do it for any movie, like realistically, like someone who's alive who could do it, who would you like to see do it?
I mean, Fincher. I want Fincher to do, I guess I'd want him to do Seven. I'd want Fincher to do Seven.
That's a good one. That's a really good one.
Jake, he would have Kevin? Some amazing stories.
Yeah. I'd like to see Spielberg do Jurassic Park.
I think I would do, so Tarantino doesn't do commentary tracks. I remember like when I was going through a phase where I was obsessed with buying everything his name was on, like even I would buy the movie Hero because it was Quentin Tarantino Presents Hero with Jet Li. There was a commentary that Quentin did on Hostel 1 or 2 with Eli Roth. And then Quentin also did a commentary on True Romance, both films he didn't direct. So I've never heard a commentary track from Quentin Tarantino on Dogs or Pulp Fiction. I probably would do Pulp. Like I would.
But do you think he could focus long enough to do an, because I feel he would instantly start talking about like the opening scene. And then we'll just go off on 10,000 and never actually talk about, because I thought about Tarantino, but I was like, I don't know how good of like an audio commentator he would be, because I don't know if you could get him to focus on his movie for 2.5 hours. You know what I mean?
He was good. Yeah, I know what you mean. But he was really good on the True Romance commentary. If anybody out there hasn't heard his commentary on True Romance, it is amazing. It's very interesting to hear him talk about it, because again, it's a film he did not direct that he gave to Tony Scott. And, you know, ended up doing Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. So it's a very interesting concept to hear a guy who wrote a movie that didn't direct it talk about the film. It almost was like an outer body thing, I think, for him. But Tarantino on Pulp Fiction would probably be my ultimate, no question.
All right, let's throw to an actual director, a director that we were able to get some time with this week. And her name is Debs Patterson. She, again, like I said at the top of the show, directed a documentary that's called The Skywalker Legacy. And it's on the Blu-ray DVD for the new Rise of Skywalker film, which, again, I think some people have been able to pick up. It has amazing access to the Lucasfilm archives. It has a ton of really great footage from the making of The Rise of Skywalker from JJ's film, including Carrie Fisher's, what's supposed to be the first scene that they're shooting that would have included Carrie Fisher, and a lot of other really great insight. It was great for Debs to sit down and talk to us. And I think as we got deeper into the production of her film and her thought process, she really talked about how documentaries come together and the amazing legacy that Star Wars has in general with its fans and with its films. So without further ado, I'm going to throw it to the Real Blend interview with Debs Patterson on behalf of Star Wars. Debs, one thing I noticed watching the documentary was just how much Star Wars pays attention to its own legacy and how much it honors it. And I'm wondering if there's any other film series that you can actually compare that pays as much attention to the fact that it has a legacy as large as Star Wars does.
Oh, man, that's a curveball. Seriously. I'm going to swerve that in the first instance I was thinking about this. Somebody asked me the other day, like, why, what is it about Star Wars that makes it so special? And that thing, that kind of, whatever is that umbilical cord that goes throughout of like always being connected back to the beginning of it or the source of it or whatever, is definitely part of that, isn't it? Like it was, you know, during the filming, at the beginning of the whole thing, one of the one thing that Kathy Kennedy said that she wanted this thing to contemplate was, you know, why is it that this thing has this, you know, that Star Wars has this singular place in people's kind of minds and hearts and in cinematic history? Like, you know, like why is it the only sort of Western cinema myth? And the, so maybe that answers the question. Maybe there is another one and that's fine. I don't have to think of one on the spot.
The only one I was sort of close to is Bond, but you know, just because it's been around as long.
Yeah, okay.
I don't see the same passion though that you do for something like Star Wars.
Do you? I don't. Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's definitely passionate fans with that, but it's reinvented. Has it reinvented itself more times?
Well, probably. Sure. Every time they recast the lead.
And it definitely has more of a tongue-in-cheek sort of. It doesn't. It's self. Not that Star Wars isn't self-aware, but it's self-aware in a way that Star Wars. It doesn't believe its own myth. It's kind of. It's self-aware about its own myth. Like right. There's something about the Star Wars thing that is sort of true, and that's part of the amazingness of it. Maybe I don't know. Yeah, no, that's fair. Bond is fair.
I absolutely love watching the documentary because I love seeing the different behind the scenes moments. The quicksand moment was mind blowing. Just the footage of them sliding down to that lower level was so cool. And those are the types of scenes that I love watching documentaries because it gives an appreciation for all those amazing people behind the scenes. It sheds a light on those particular people. I was curious for you, what was the scene that you were there to see on set be filmed that was the most different in the final product? Meaning like the way it looked the day you shot the documentary versus the way the movie turned out, not in a good or bad way, just something that was so different from what you remember seeing filmed.
Yeah. I mean, to your starting point, that was if the one thing that Kathy said at the beginning was it needs to contemplate the why of Star Wars or what it is about this thing. The thing that JJ said at the beginning is that he wanted the crew to be celebrated. Yes. He didn't just want the doc to be about the famous people. And so we worked incredibly hard to try and follow enough of those stories and get, I mean, just the amount of cool shit that was going on every single day in every single department. It was eye popping. I'm trying to think about that. Like the, I mean, because I'm also a filmmaker, so part of me was like getting off on. I see how that's going to work, and I see where that's going to go. I mean, in some ways, the thing that I was most looking forward to seeing was how Exegol would extrapolate up from, you know, the details that there were.
Yeah.
Because obviously it was this massive, massive scale, right? So like there were, you know, you get these huge things that were just going to be tiny details of the final set when you saw it on screen. So I was definitely looking forward to seeing that. And that was something that you couldn't see a lot of on the set. Yeah, I mean, the throne was there, obviously, but you couldn't see a lot beyond that. So that was cool. The battle, and maybe a little bit the space battle as well, but the, you know, the sort of final showdown battle. But the, I mean, like in Cardington studio, you know, that, you know, like the huge side of the Star Destroyer in Cardington. Yes. Like, that was fucking epic, man. It was amazing.
Yeah, and to your point, because this is not really a question, this is more of a statement. I was watching the documentary, and what I loved about the filmmaking aspect of it was giving people the idea of the animatronics. Like, the sequence when that gigantic slithering animal with all the different people are inside of it, or, like, those details in the creature's eyes that were just used in the film from behind as the ship flies over. Like, what an amazing way to shed light on these important animators and everybody behind the scenes. So thank you. That was very appreciated from a filmmaking fan. You know what I mean? It was great.
I'm so glad. It was like, it was amazing. It was amazing to see. And kudos to those guys. It's ridiculous.
You know, aside from all the amazing footage that you shot on Rise of Skywalker, you also bring in a lot of unbelievable archival footage from the original films. And I'm curious, like, what your access to that archival footage is. Does Lucasfilm pretty much just, like, open the vault and say, like, go nuts, have fun? Or are you provided, like, very specific clips where they go, like, here's what we'll give you, like, play with these?
Well, no, it was, it sort of started off, because there's, like, 350 hours of archive from the 70s and 80s.
Wow.
So it started off with them saying, you know, very logically, you know, just tell us what you're looking for, and you know, we'll get our guys searching. But it was like it was kind of a funny deal where, you know, we had 1,000 hours of stuff that we shot on Rise of Skywalker, and we had not very long of a time to edit the doc, right? We had to deliver the documentary at the same time as the movie was delivered.
Oh, wow. So, really?
Yeah, no. So it was like 3.5 months or something. By the time that we started our editing process, which is obviously much later than they started their editing process, but we had about 3.5 months to do it. So in the end, it just made much more sense for, while the editors were getting up to speed, we had two incredibly talented editors working on this, Rebecca Valente and Carl Jordan. So while they were getting up to speed with the, you know, the 1,000 hours that we'd shot, I sat and watched, 350 hours of the archive material. Like, they made it available through the Avid, which was amazing. Like, it was amazing. And they've just completely re-scanned everything. So a lot of it isn't properly logged yet. And that's why it looks so good. Like, it looks amazing.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't do anything to that beyond grade it in our post process. Like, the new scans are just phenomenal. And the, and I think they found a lot of stuff and resynced it. Like, Sky Sound has, they went through all their reels. They resynced it with all the, you know, the Super 16 reels that there were from the original behind the scenes stuff. I mean, there is such incredible material in there. So, you know, it was something like, without doing that, you know, where the bit where Rosemary and I'm going to forget his name, Martin, I think it is. I hope it is. In the droid workshop, in Babu Frick's workshop, and they suddenly start talking about Greebles, yeah. Right?
Right.
The only reason that I knew that there was a bit in the desert where that guy's talking about Greebles is because of having watched it through. Like, that's not logged anywhere. Do you know what I mean? You just, right, it was right. Little moments like that of like, oh, I'm pretty sure we shot that. And then, you know, so that was, you know, slightly chaotic fun, but real fun of kind of watching the archive, thinking about, I remember people doing something like that. Or I remember her putting the gloop on the snake's teeth in the cave, and then there's Phil Tibbetts doing, you know, in the,
I love that match cut. That was so cool.
It's so cool, isn't it? It's so
yeah.
Cool.
I was geeking out because to me, that's kind of what the documentary became. And this is, you know, the idea of what was done in 77 is not that much different than what's being done now.
Right.
We just have a little extra tools in the toolbox with the CGI. But to me, that's what the documentary does, is it shows you that the old school style of filmmaking, that 35 millimeter, just the practical cameras on set, that's what still works.
And this,
there's a reason why it still works.
Right, right. And this wasn't like a thesis that we went into the doc trying to prove. Like, this was just like, well, hang on. It was sort of, everybody was talking a lot of times, you know, or it came up a lot of times in the stuff that we were filming, like, oh, so we went back and looked at the process that they used to do, or, well, this is still the same, like with Chewie's, you know, Chewie's whole deal is still hair hand-stitched into, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Sure. And the, C-3PO. Right. That mask shot was so cool. Right. The one from the wide shot out, that was awesome.
Well, it's not broken, right? Why try to fix it?
Well, this is it. And so, then when, like, watching the archive, again, you kind of, like, it really is the same thing, apart from, like you say, you know, it's like at the same time, they're kind of staying tied in a lot of ways to the original techniques and having to push it forward. You know, every time it's got to be pushed forward again. And there was stuff that they did on this that, you know, they were inventing it as they went along in a kind of, holy cow, I hope you know what you're doing sort of a way. I mean, like Roger Guyette and his team going, I'm pretty sure we can pull this off. I'm pretty sure, you know. But that feels like it's always been the DNA. I mean, that is partly what's amazing about this stuff, isn't it? Like, yes, the mythological, you know, the sort of fairy tale big-hearted side of it, you know, and deep meaning side of it, but also the kind of, you know, these practical techniques matched with the most insane technological advance every single time. I mean, I'll tell you what, there's a piece of footage from the archive that was gutted that we didn't manage to get in, which is the I'm gonna forget his name. Who was the SFX guy on the original movie? Ha, I'm gonna test you now. Who was the SFX guy in the original movies?
Gosh, I'm going to Neil Scanlon, but Scanlon's doing
Wait. The guy who did did he just do Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? Is it Dykstra?
No.
John Dykstra.
No, it's a British guy. He's got dark hair and a beard.
I'll look it up real fast. While
okay, no, look it up. So, but he's there's a piece of
Dykstra was on Star Wars, though, right? I am right about that. He was a special effects artist on Star Wars, John Dykstra.
Let's see.
Well, maybe I'm laughing at you. Maybe you're right. I mean, like you literally might be right.
Because the only reason I know that name is because we had Quentin Tarantino on our show recently for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and he talked about John Dykstra being on Hollywood and making him do a full blown practical one shot where when Pitt drives to the drive-in at the beginning and they go over the theater. Those are real like miniature cars they set out.
No, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's the wrong guy. I don't know.
I'm still digging. It's going to take me a little while.
I'm just looking for a photo.
Yeah, unfortunately, when you go to IMDb for the visual effects department of Star Wars, there are more names than a small one.
There are a lot of names.
Anywho, while you're digging that up, I was very curious because I loved a scene that occurred relatively early that it kind of woke me up to the fact that, oh, this is a documentary about the filmmaking process. Was Harrison Ford in an archival shot kind of waving off the camera of like, don't shoot this, you know?
Right.
And it's really funny that with Jake and Kevin as co-hosts, we run into this often. Kevin always wants to know how things are done. Jake would rather not know how things are done. And I'm curious, like, what was your take on that? And was there any sort of pushback from the people as you filmed them filming the process? You know, because a lot of times that shows the imperfections, you know, or
it's
a peek behind the curtain that maybe some film fans don't necessarily want. What was the attitude from that on the set?
There was like a mantra from the beginning, partly out of the first conversation with JJ and partly also getting a sense pretty quickly, I don't know what would be important to him, but also like for me as a fan, like I don't want something that, I don't want to see any underwear, do you know what I mean? Like I don't want to, I don't want the bubble to get burst. I want to get as close as possible to the magic of it without spoiling the magic of it. So that was like a mantra. That was basically the mantra all the way through. Like, how close can we get to this without ruining it? And that was the hope, basically, with the doc.
Yeah, and I think you do a great job with it because, like, I'm interested in it. But to me, the things you have in your documentary enhance the experience for me. Enhances the work that goes into it. Now, that's just the way I love that kind of footage. But I guess my question would be: I noticed as we got closer to slates or the cameras, there was Trixie written on the film as the fake title being used as the movie was shot. Do you know the meaning behind that? And two, what other fake names did you see around the set?
I mean, Trixie's easy. It's got nine in the middle. It's got XI for nine in the middle.
Oh, that's cool. Wow. That's really,
really
cool.
I totally did
so
not.
So obvious, we just went right over it.
I will say this though, in our defense, nothing JJ does is easy to figure out.
No,
like,
no.
Like he's always, you know what I mean? So like, I feel like he wouldn't make it that easy. There's no way, but I guess he did.
So. Yeah, right. He like double bluffed.
What other
him,
fake
right?
names did you notice ever being used?
What other? I mean, no, but everything's codenamed. Everything, like everything. So there's nothing that isn't codenamed the whole time.
Like, is JJ Abrams codenamed?
JJ Abrams is. Not, yeah, no, the but all of the, yeah, the cast have codes, the characters have codes, the locations have codes. They're like, I mean, it's impressive. So you're remembering like three, especially with cast, you're remembering three versions of everything, as well, yeah.
That's
crazy. What is one crazy code name you can tell us without, I mean, you don't have to give us like specifics if you don't want to. We're just nerds about that.
Yeah, no, I get it. I don't want to get shot. they train you well on this.
We
stuff.
Hear that a lot when it comes to Disney, Disney productions.
Yeah, dude. If I think of one that definitely couldn't be problematic, I'll say, let me think.
All right, we'll come back to
okay.
that.
You do an amazing job of really in just two hours, not just 2 hours, like telling the entire arc that is The Rise of Skywalker while also flashing back to the legacy before. But there were a couple of big like pre-production stories that obviously didn't make it into the documentary. One of the big ones being that Colin Trevorrow was going to be on the project and then was replaced by J.J. Abrams. Right. Was that ever an option to include that storyline in the documentary, or does Disney sort of say, yeah, we don't really want to talk about that?
No, it was, I mean, there definitely wasn't a mandate from either Disney or Kathy or J.J. or anybody like, you must talk about this, you mustn't talk about that. I don't think I'm lying to say that. There were things that they wanted to cover, for sure. Like Carrie, obviously. And, you know, they wanted to know that we would be able to do that in a way that kind of worked. But the... it's to the point of spoiling the magic kind of thing. Like, how do you start a story of this kind of movie with a load of politics that, you know, most fans don't really care about, like the you know, and it's, which isn't to say that there isn't a that isn't part of the story, but man, there's so many parts of the story of this thing that we couldn't fit into 2 hours. So it was tough to find the beginning. I will say that it was tough to find the right way into the to this one, you know, because it's the last of 3 movies and it's the last of 9 movies, and it, you know, it was. Yeah, there was kind of the sort of complicated narrative about the beginning and how much you need to know. So, yeah, it kind of, we played around with a few different things, trying to find the right way in. And then it, ultimately, it was just like, screw it, man, let's just go day one, bosh, off we go.
It works.
Well, and that's exactly where I was going to go with the next sort of follow-up is that I always love talking to documentary filmmakers because I don't think people really process the way into the story is so completely different than, you know, having a script that's your point A to point B method.
Word.
Instead, you start with so much, you know, and you can chisel it down to 5 or 6 avenues that you could pursue, and you have the footage to almost back it up. I was curious, what were some other ones that you were sort of entertaining?
Oh,
of, like,
man. There were so many, serious kudos to documentary people. Like, I haven't done a documentary before, and you kind of, I was like, oh yeah, no, the difficult things were with drama, obviously, because you got to get the whole thing up on its feet. You got to get everyone to come with you. You got to get the money. You got to get blah, blah, blah. No. Like, documentary is way harder. Like, way harder. Those cats are ninjas. Seriously. Because you have to...
Ending. Think of the ones that don't have an ending.
Oh,
you
don't.
Know?
I can't.
That work their way through and hope that there's a resolution provided. That makes me petrified thinking about every doc subject. It's just like, what if you don't know what your ending is?
I know. Like, what if it never happens? And what if you, anyway, seriously. And they like edit their movie and write the scripts at the same time. I mean, I'm sure people are a bit more orderly than that sometimes, but I'm impressed. If we were struggling for a minute to find the right way in, we had like 7 different endings that we could do. That was for sure. that was a tough one to find. The thing that opened up the beginning was finding those tourists by the fence.
Yeah.
It was literally just,
that was great.
They're so cool, aren't they? They're so cool.
By the way, is there that for the new productions now? Or is it so guarded that no one even knows where to go?
Yeah, not really. I think you would be chased off long before anything like that. I, one of the things that I regret not filming actually was the security guys on the movie, because they were like, they were brilliant characters anyway. That would have been a fascinating storyline that we just, it was one too many things.
A sequel, do another one.
Yes. I'm really curious about your day to day in regards to the filming. So, looking at, for example, there's a great moment in the documentary where we go to footage of JJ as he's announcing to the crew, this is the first time we're going to shoot a scene with Princess Leia, or General Leia in that particular sense. And that scene was so powerful to see JJ take that mic and kind of go up there and say that. And you see, I think he actually offers Billy Lord the mic for a second and she says, no, I'm okay. How did your day-to-day work? Did you know in advance what things were being filmed and you were going to go in? And did you have like an idea of what days you were shooting, what footage you wanted to get? Like, did you know JJ was going to give that speech, or you just happened to pick that up on the camera? How much of that stuff is pre-planned? Did you know going in?
I think on that particular occasion, I'd asked him, are you going to say something? And he said, probably. So
cool.
I didn't know when particularly it was going to happen. But that's where, the team that we had to film, I was, I don't normally operate, but I realized very, very quickly, like documentary, I don't really know how directors stand by a camera and like whisper direction.
I was watching JJ in your documentary doing that. I couldn't believe how close JJ was to Daisy in that scene where she looks into the camera.
Right?
I couldn't believe he was right there. Yeah. I've never seen, normally they're like in Video Village or they're back behind. I don't know. I've never seen that, but that was
so
cool.
He's not a Video Village guy. he's right up in there with them. This was it. It was... we had three cameras, two incredibly talented other DPs who we kind of I would sort of say, can you take this area, can you take that area, and sort of figured out pretty quick who would have a natural inclination towards what kind of stuff. So Chin Okoronkwo, who was one of our camera operators, she had this amazing ability of making friends with literally everybody, like everybody. Mm-hmm. So anybody in the workshops a lot of the show and tells wouldn't be scheduled. So the only way that you know is if somebody in the department tells you that's going to happen. So like the stuff with Ian, the Empress, the show and tells, we only knew about because of Chin. The Warwick Davis stuff, we only knew about because of Chin. You know, lots of stuff like that. She was amazing. And Will and I would be more on set with the unit by and large, as a generalization. And Will Mitchell, who's the other one, he was shooting with a Venice. He was shooting handheld with a Venice a lot of the time, which is no mean feat, my friend.
I'll tell you right now, I jumped off my couch every single time I saw a 35mm film camera. Just like seeing Dan Mendel work, like an absolute genius. But Jake, go ahead, buddy.
I love documentaries about movies that make me go back and look at a movie differently. And one of the things I now love thinking about is sort of the tribute to John Williams. Because John Williams is a genius, and I think arguably like maybe the greatest composer that's ever lived. And the way that they pay tribute to him in this movie, I thought was brilliant. And I'm so glad that you guys sort of brought that to life. And I'm curious as to what that moment was like to be a part of. And then were there like other Easter eggs that maybe didn't even make it into the documentary that you're aware of that you can think about?
I think we tried to get most of the Easter eggs we were aware of, we tried to get in. I don't think there were any that didn't make it. Let me think about that. But the John Williams thing was incredible. And I'd been tracking that for some 7 months or something. Like, you know, because Rosemary Brandenburg, who I love, had talked us through all of the different, we do have somewhere on film, we have all 51. She talked us through all 51 of the tributes that they did.
Release that.
I know. We need to get Lucasfilm onto it. I emailed her the other day actually to say, look, you have to do a full list. Like, the internet would love you for doing a full list.
That'd be awesome.
So that was during the shoot. And then obviously because John is, Mr. Williams is not traveling so much these days. I mean, he's still incredible. I got to tell you, being in the room, like getting to be in the recording studio while they were, laying that stuff down. I won't forget that ever for the rest of my life, ever, ever. It was amazing. And you know, one of those things where you're like, I don't know why I get to be in this room, but thank you.
Yeah.
That's
amazing.
I mean, yeah. It was ridiculous. So basically, they'd done all of the, they'd made all the tributes during the shoot, and then shipped them over to LA, and then recreated the little bar area in the backlot of Bad Robot. So basically, that was happening. That happened as a little piece during the edit. And it was, again, it was all so secretive. But I had my people by that point to say when it was going to be happening. So Major was there to film it. And then afterwards, JJ was like, I don't know how you knew that was happening, but thank you so much for getting it.
Wait, Debs, are you in the movie?
Am I in the movie? No.
Yeah. No.
I voiced an alien in the space battle. But then it got, they re-edited that section. So I'm somewhere on a cutting room floor. Me and Chris Terrio are two of the kind of horse aliens.
That's closer than the rest of us are ever going to get to being in Star Wars.
Do we have time to go through one more question each? Do you have time?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you don't mind? Okay, I will wrap my portion up with this one, which is hacky, but still I want to know. This is as much of a capsule, you know, to the filming of episode 9 as it is to the legacy as a whole. And you had such great access to the cast and the people responsible for it. And if you could pick one other Star Wars film from the entire series that you could have lived on and captured the insights of everybody involved, which one would you choose?
I think Empire. I think it would have to be Empire. But the beginning, like when Lee Brackett was working on it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I would have loved to watch her process with dialogue and that kind of stuff. And also to hear what would have happened if she hadn't passed. Empire would have been amazing. The footage from the snow, when they're shooting the snow, looked absolutely mental. Right, and then Cloud City. Empire would be the one.
Billy Dee in his prime.
Seriously, yes. I mean, that guy's amazing. He's amazing.
That'd be great. Good answer.
Yeah. Yeah, that was incredible. I'm curious. I mean, obviously, you're on set. I was curious what your favorite moment was to operate. You were on the camera. You were operating it. It's all you in that moment. Like, what was your favorite scene to have shot?
Do you know what? Ironically, I think, I mean, apart from obviously the Bakersfield, I'll tell you that the code name for that was Bakersfield, where the homestead right at the very end.
Cool.
Yeah, no, that, when that, I mean, it was
nice comeback.
Yeah,
with that full circle.
So we got it.
Wow, that was really like in tune
with the because you're there and not everything's for real, you know, like the homestead is there for real, the sunset is there for real, like it's so weird because you know that this is the end of the movie and then this massive rainbow comes out. And then, you know, we're about to wrap in Jordan, like shooting that stuff. Everybody's tired and they know that the work's been good and the emotions are high. Like, that was amazing. But I think my favorite thing to shoot was the, ironically, it was just a little, for the flashback. You know, the flashback fight that happens between Luke and Leia.
Yeah.
Yes.
In the jungle, which was, it just
With Billy Lord.
Oh my word, it looked amazing. It looked amazing.
Wait, that was you operating that moment? I was watching that on my couch with my wife, and I was like, this is an amazing shot of a behind-the-scenes shot. Like, it was like a legitimately cool shot.
Is that the one with JJ silhouetted in the middle? That's me operating that one.
And they all have the. I love that he has them have practical sabers on set.
Totally.
I just love that he does that.
Well, this is the thing that you're watching it, and it's the same. You like C-3PO is like just walking around, and there's C-3PO, and what the fuck, like that? Excuse me, that doesn't get old ever.
Speaking of things that don't get old, and you've kind of already answered this, but I'm going to ask for sort of another answer. We are all fortunate enough on this podcast to have moments where we'll get to interview someone, or we'll be on set and we'll look at each other and just go like, how are we here? Like, how is this a thing where our life exists? I know you mentioned sort of having that sensation around John Williams, but what was another moment in your experience with this documentary where you kind of just paused and looked around and just sort of went like, how is this my life? Like, how am I bearing witness to this?
On the Falcon. I got to go in the Millennium Falcon.
Oh, I just got chills.
Yes.
Which chair did you sit in?
I sat in both seats in the cockpit, like both the fun things. And then I sat at the chessboard.
What do they have there for the pieces? Is anything there? Is it all digital?
I know, it's so disappointing. You're like looking for the thing to turn it on. But cool. Like sitting there, and it's a 360 set. That part of it is a 360 deal. Like everywhere you look is the Falcon. Like you don't lose it anywhere. It's amazing.
I'll tell you right now that when the I told you this earlier, but when people were coming down the chute of that quicksand, that was my favorite footage I've seen in a documentary in a long time. I to be honest with you, I was always wondering how they did that, and I thought it was like CG. I didn't know how they pulled that off or how they went underneath and came back up. That was one of the coolest reveals I've ever had about a special effect. It was so cool. So thank you for that.
I know. Wicked.
We joke all the time that, you know, if you're at a party and everybody's, you know, trading war stories, you kind of sit back and you have one in your back pocket of just like, well, if I pull this one out, like this is going to be the be all end all. And Dev just dropped one on us. That was the be all and end all. Like, I sat everywhere on the Falcon. What have you guys done with your lives?
Yeah, right. That's crazy.
Well, so the documentary is called The Skywalker Legacy, and obviously you guys can find it in the bonus features for the new Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. Debs, thank you so much for taking the time join the Real Blend podcast. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Real pleasure.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Bye.
We have to thank Disney and Lucasfilm for getting Debs on the show, and definitely go out and grab a copy of The Rise of Skywalker for the movie. Obviously, you want to add it to your collection, but also for that documentary. It's a terrific special feature. All right, news for this week. So the Golden Globes are reacting to everything that's going on in the coronavirus community, unfortunately. And as all of these things are affecting the way that movies get released, the Golden Globes are changing their eligibility rules. The story made it sound as if the filmmakers who were putting things out were more concerned about their Globes eligibility than I think people actually are. But there was a stipulation, obviously, for a film to qualify for a Golden Globe at the end of the year that had to play in theaters. The Globes, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which gives out the Golden Globes, is going to relax that stature. And they'll basically say that you can do something on a paid streaming service or a cable streaming service. It doesn't necessarily have to run in a theater in order for it to qualify. So Trolls World Tour, you're still in the game. You'll be able to get that animated feature Golden Globe nomination. Don't worry about it, Universal. You didn't ruin that. I guess my bigger question is going to be, is this now a precedent that's being set for some of the bigger award shows if this thing continues? Because the next point we're going to get to is the fact that new movies might not be coming for a really long time. And is the Globes just setting a bar for what we think other groups like the Academy, maybe the Broadcast Film Critics Association, of which we are members, that we're going to have to sort of pursue this other type thing, that a movie doesn't have to play in theaters to be eligible for an award?
I find it interesting because, listen, right now in this particular time period, it makes sense. And I feel like with the pandemic that we're involved in now, with the coronavirus, that this is really the only way for films to be eligible in regards to this time period that they can't play in movies. So for me, I don't think films that don't play theatrically should be up for Academy Awards, just because I think the theatrical experience is part of that factor. But with the time we're in now, I have no problem with it. Clearly, there's no other way. But next year, so yes, Oscars, Globes, that's totally fine for 2021 award shows. 2020 is a different year. It's not normal. So next year, when we're out of all this and we're back to normal movies, that's when I think it should go back to the regular eligibility. I do not think that that should stand. Personally.
So wait, so I'm not trying to be a smartass. I'm genuinely sort of confused. So at this point, what you're saying is in order, like, a movie no longer has to play in theaters. It could just go straight to Netflix and be considered, up for contention. So in that case, I ask you, what's the difference between something like that versus a movie that, like HBO, like the new Hugh Jackman movie that's coming to HBO?
Right. You're getting into Emmy territory here.
Oh, interesting. I see what you're saying. No, I think they have specific parameters on what streaming services it has to play on. I don't think it's a Netflix, Amazon type thing, because I think, what, like Kevin said, that would make it eligible for Emmys. But like Trolls World Tour is going to like iTunes and places where you have to pay for it. Is it a VOD?
So like in theory, if like Black Widow went to video on demand, then that could be up for as a movie. But if it went to Disney Plus,
it would not be up for it.
See, no, I think, again, I know exactly what Jake's saying. I think the eligibility means that it's a film that was made for theaters that was then put on VOD. I haven't read the fine print on this.
Okay, but then, see, that's weird too, because that Hugh Jackman movie was made for theaters and then HBO just bought it.
Well, yeah. That's different, but HBO bought it. Wait, they bought it due to the coronavirus?
No, they bought it after the Toronto Film Festival.
So that's different. Oh. So basically, in that case, the movie was purchased by HBO, but it was wait, so you're saying that movie in particular is going to HBO only, it's right?
Yeah, there's a new Hugh Jackman, Allison Janney, Ray Romano movie.
Right.
That was made with the intention of, I'm assuming, going to theaters. And right. After, sure. I want to say, maybe it was Sundance, but I want to say it was Toronto.
It was in Toronto,
HBO, you know, where it was looking for a studio for someone to buy it, HBO just happened to be the one to buy it, and now they're putting it out as that, this HBO original film.
But that's an Emmys film. That's an Emmy. So okay, so let me clarify my point. So if okay, for example, right now in the time period that we are in, Trolls, films like that that are going to VOD that were originally slated for theatrical releases. That is where I think this applies to. I don't think applies to a movie that was already going to online, like on HBO, and makes it eligible.
I have the clarification. It's right here. This is the term, pay-per-view. Instead of only considering a movie that was released in theaters or made available on pay-per-view cable or pay-per-view digital delivery.
So not HBO.
Not HBO, not even Netflix, not a streaming service. It's literally something where you're paying per view. But then it goes on to say, is not made available in theaters in the greater Los Angeles area for a minimum 7 days beginning before December 31st. So they're really, the window right now where they're only giving you this leeway is something between March 15th and April 30th. Now that could change. We're seeing all of these regulations be massaged and altered as we get further and further into this, but it's interesting that this is one of the first bodies that's implementing something like this.
But going forward, this should not be a norm. This is a temporary moment thing that makes perfect sense. But I think I still feel, and I will always feel, that a movie should not be considered to be for an Academy Award unless it has a theatrical run in some way, shape, or form. If it goes directly to like an HBO, like Jake's talking about, that's an Emmys. Movie, not a Oscars film. But I mean, Jake, your point's interesting because the movie was made theatrically, but once HBO buys it and they create a release for their platform, the movie's no longer a theatrical film. Trolls was a theatrical film that just happened to move to VOD because of circumstances. Therefore, I think that makes sense because a movie like that, which was already slated for HBO, would not even factor in this.
Let's be honest. If you buy the Hollywood Foreign Press a knife and a nice enough watch, they'll give you a Golden Globe.
Yeah, it's very true. It's whoever throws the best party. All right. So some of these films that we thought were going to be coming to VOD as a substitute instead of pushing way, way back have just decided that they are going to wait for theatrical windows. And these are the latest films that were supposed to be coming out from Sony Pictures this summer. Two of them were coming out this summer anyway. Morbius, starring Jared Leto, and the Ghostbusters reboot sequel continuation that Jason Reitman is doing. They have now moved till 2021 officially. So has Uncharted, the Mark Wahlberg, Tom Holland film based on the video game adaptation that was still filming and was filming in Berlin. And I know their production was deeply affected by the coronavirus and the quarantines that were happening in Germany because of that. So they are not able to continue. So they've also pushed to 2021. Greyhound, a Tom Hanks film, has been delayed indefinitely from June 12th that was supposed to come out. Sony is still keeping their September and October releases. One of them in October, they're calling an untitled Sony Marvel movie, which hasn't officially been announced as Venom 2, but I'm fairly certain, 100%, that that's Venom 2. And it'd be interesting to see if they move those dates off of there. But what do you guys think about yet another major studio not holding the line and not waiting to see if the situation clears anytime soon, but simply grabbing valuable real estate in 2021.
I feel like this is the release date equivalent of the Titanic. Right now, everyone's just looking for a lifeboat trying to get off. At this point, I mean, you know, so much so that studios aren't even looking at, well, maybe August or September or October of this year. They're just going, screw it. Let's just not worry about it. And let's just push it to next year.
So they're going to flush the rest of the year?
I mean dude, they just flushed. Isn't this the first instance of a studio like pushing just their entire slate? Like not movie per movie per movie. Remember how big of a deal like 3 weeks ago when Bond moved? It was like
that feels like a year ago at this point.
Like now we're at a point where like a day comes and like five movies get pushed. And we're like, oh hey, five like the world. I feel like our world stopped when they moved Bond because it was such this mat. And now like five movies got pushed yesterday, including a Tom Hanks movie, and we all just sort of went, well, yeah, that's it. But here's the transition. Are they going to push Tenet?
Well, I mean, the Tenet thing is that's a sensitive subject, Jake.
Kevin can't even talk about it.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to sort of set the shot up for Kevin.
Let me clear my mind of the thought process I was in before Tenet, because now I don't want to get too upset. But yeah, this particular situation has gotten very interesting. One thing I've been questioning is why things are moving when they're moving. Mm-hmm. Sean, last week we discussed In the Heights, which what I believe was a late June release,
right?
And they moved, and it was 3 months from being released, and they still moved the film.
Yes.
That became a question of whether or not was the movie even done? Is this a post-production question? Are they editing the film and not able to edit it and get it out in time? So mm-hmm. then we started to wonder, like, that's a long time. 3 months is a long time. Why can't we wait till April or May to see where we are and then do it? And then we had a great discussion about marketing campaigns and all that kind of stuff. Now we're moving July movies, which is really worrisome for me. Like, you're talking about a movie studio moving like massive films out of July, and we're only at the end of March right now. And, you know, we obviously all hope this gets better sooner rather than later, but moving a movie out of July is concerning to me. Not that they know something we don't know, but I just find that to be a very strange move. And I get it. I get the marketing aspect of it. But then you have Warner Brothers, you move Wonder Woman, right? From June to August. That's not staying in August, right? I mean, I feel like theaters won't probably open until maybe August, probably September. And now with these July pushes, we're talking about 4 months of no releases, which is insane. Now, here's the interesting thing. Tenet's a very interesting question, but what about Top Gun? Top Gun just sitting in June right now, right? It comes out in June. And Paramount hasn't moved yet. Now, Paramount has made some interesting moves already. They moved Lovebirds from a theatrical to a Netflix.
Right.
Right? They moved Quiet Place indefinitely. And they're, you know, Bad Boys is Sony. So we're now dealing with Top Gun. Why is Top Gun sitting there? So I guess it's interesting to me because Top Gun.
Well, because they have a Tom Cruise movie next summer.
Right. But if Top Gun is sitting there in June and Sony is moving July 31st films like Morbius.
Right.
Why is Top Gun not moving?
But you just have to maybe just assume that different studios are maybe holding out hope. Maybe that may. I mean, will it probably be moved? Yeah, I really do. I honestly think Tenet and Top Gun are going to be moved, but they're probably taking it one by one. Going like, well, maybe we'll see. I mean, like, what's at this point? It's not like any of them are paying for TV spots or for any kind of promotion. Like, what's the harm in just kind of holding off and seeing what happens?
This is going to be a stupid question, and I'm just going to ask it hypothetically. Let's say like a month from now, everything's back to normal.
Right.
Perfectly back to normal. We're all back to normal. Can these studios reverse their decision? So, for example, let's say April 20th rolls around and everything is great.
They have a vaccine. We have a vaccine.
Right.
You know, everything's everybody clear. Can get it. Yes.
Can you move Wonder Woman back to June 5th?
I think that movies that are finished can move.
Wonder Woman's
in.
Definitely done because that got delayed already,
right?
Initially,
right. So it feels
is Tenet done?
Tenet's not done. There's no way Tenet's done because, like, I feel like, again, I'm saying that as an opinion, but I'm almost certain it's not done because I feel like Nolan's probably editing until the last minute.
Some of these guys really do work and right until day or two before it comes out.
Didn't we hear that, like, didn't Krasinski just finish A Quiet Place before we saw
it? Yeah, same with Invisible Man. I saw Invisible Man 2 nights after Lee Winnell locked picture or locked the movie completely.
It's crazy.
And I remember, Jake, do you remember at the Tron junket, Joseph Krasinski walked into the theater in the El Capitan and said, I just finished this movie and I just brought the hard drive here myself. And like that, like, there's Nolan's probably in VFX. Now, here's the thing.
I can't imagine that kind of pressure, by the way. It's like a sidebar. Yeah. Like your junket starts in 2 days. Like this $200 million movie isn't done yet.
But if you're okay, so if you're Nolan and you're Tenet, so Tenet probably isn't, again, this is an opinion or, you know, I'm just guessing, but Tenet's probably in a very rigorous post-production process prior to all this happening. VFX, editing, ADR, all those things that you need to do in post-production. They can't do that now. Right. I mean, especially with the CDC guidelines and all the different stay at home aspects of it, you can't get people to come to studios and ADR dialogue for you, can you?
I think you can. No, not right now, probably. No. Yeah. Well, can you do it from home? I mean, how many people are able to work from home and do something like that?
I mean, but a movie of that magnitude, you think it's all in one spot in Nolan's house? There's no way.
Oh, yeah. No.
I feel like he's such a perfectionist that he would want to control every aspect. Okay. I have a question for you. So let's say hypothetically, they push Tenet to December, November, December, okay. And it becomes their awards season movie. Okay. Like they decide like, okay, not going to be our big summer movie. It's going to be an awards season movie. And let's push it a step further and say one, like not necessarily not because it's not going to be good, but like because the competition is a little bit less. Let's say this is the year that Nolan wins his Oscar because he's not really competing against anything else. Would it bother you that he won an Oscar in a year in which like everyone goes, yeah, but there really wasn't that much competition?
No.
That timing is interesting because, and I heard Sean's no, and I didn't mean to step over you, Sean, but I think that the timing of that is interesting. So if movie theaters pop back up, or when they pop back up in like August, right? There's still a good 5 month period there of Oscar films to come out. Now,
but of movies that haven't been, like they might not
true.
Be done.
That is true. So that it's going to be an interesting discussion. Would it bother me? No, because no one would have an Oscar and that would make me happy. But I mean, under the circumstances, I don't wish that to be the case. I want Nolan to win for a movie he deserves to win for. I haven't seen Tenet, obviously. But the interesting thing about Tenet, and this is what I'm hoping, and I guess this is just the optimist element in my mind about the situation, is that movie theaters will reopen the week of Tenet and everyone goes to the theaters.
They're not going to all open up this on the same day.
I get that. Listen, I know I'm speaking.
And even then you're not going to want that because people, that's not going to necessarily be the first thing people rush out. Like if anything, that would cause Tenet to have a little bit of a lesser weekend.
Would it though? Because
the first weekend we can all go out and do stuff. I got to be honest. I don't think the first thing people are going to want to do is go into a movie.
See, again, this is maybe just a magical thinking of mine, but I'm thinking if everything lifts on a Monday and everyone's acclimated back into the week and then Nolan drops Tenet on a Friday, 717, as Gabe was talking about with the number 717, that would be the coolest thing ever because Nolan...
717, people are at a bar getting hammered.
No, listen, I think people are at home getting hammered right now. Like I feel like people want to get out of the
house. Yeah, I know, but people want to go outside and get hammered with other people who are getting hammered.
I get that.
They're not going to a movie theater.
Yeah, but there are a lot of people like you, me, and Sean and Gabe that live for movie theater experiences. So for me, I would argue that's the first place I'll probably go. I would rather go to a movie theater than go to a bar any day of the week. And I think like,
yeah, but we're talking, you know, we are not representative of
mainstream audiences. Yeah. The mainstream audience.
But also who's seeing Tenet? Nolan has a really passionate following. And I think that like Nolan's fans, again, this is magical thinking. We're speaking completely hypothetical, but this is the last question I'll pose. Cause I know we have to move on. Gabe, and Dune is your number one most anticipated movie of the year. Gabe, correct? Jake, what's yours?
Probably Dune. Okay. Yeah.
So let's say, hypothetically, what's your number one most anticipated movie of the year, Sean? It's Mank, right? Mank.
It's Mank. It's Fincher, but I'm not sure what's going to happen with that now. It's probably next year now.
Okay. Well, Fincher, I know Fincher finished production, like physical photography on Mank. Okay. You know, he could theoretically be editing. Okay. So we get to December, right? Tenet's pushed to December, as Jake said. One of them has to go, Dune or Tenet. Which one do you want to see in December? Is it still Dune?
I'm pushing Dune. I'm pushing Dune.
Wow. I'm the only Tenet out of the
two? No, I'm pushing Dune out of the way. Okay. I'll take Tenet. I'm taking Tenet over Dune.
Yes.
Okay, let me ask you guys something, though. Okay, let's say like all of this gets resolved by, you know, by August or September.
Okay.
And in theory, they could push Dune and slide Tenet into that spot. The implication being that it's potentially an Oscar movie, right?
if they don't push it to that spot, does it imply that it's not an Oscar movie?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because I guess Hollywood came out in July. That was an Oscar film. Right. I mean, I do think that the Oscar time period has changed a lot over the years. I remember Grand Budapest Hotel coming out like in February or something like that, or Get Out.
Yeah. God, I love
We've gotten to a point, though, where I do think a movie can keep traction, like Get Out kept traction all the way through the year. But what's interesting about the Tenet discussion is you're mentioning August, and this gets back into the exact discussion we were having 2 weeks ago. We are dealing now where movie theaters are designed to have scheduled runs in IMAX and Dolby. Now, if Wonder Woman's moving to August, they have some type of IMAX deal there because Patty shot the film in 65 millimeter.
But do you
IMAX.
Think that those deals are just blowing up right now?
No, I think that's what's happening. I think that's why Bond moved to November. I think what they're doing is they're going, okay, like Fast and Furious 9 didn't need to move 12 months ahead. It did because it found a window where, remember, they have to deal with not only the domestic schedules, the international schedules. So like every theater in China that's going to run Fast and Furious 9 has to somehow be open for IMAX and Dolby the same time, if the release is the same, in the U.S. So they have to map all that out. That's why Universal was smart. You push that thing a year out, you're good. But it's interesting because what other movies were there? So with Wonder Woman moving to August, they found an IMAX window. Tenet has to find an IMAX window. Think about it. If you're Nolan, you're not opening up without IMAX. You have to have an IMAX opening. So he's actually in a bit of a tighter situation because he has to find a very specific window.
It also means next year, if any of these dates hold, is going to be the most staggering year we've ever seen in terms of huge movies every single weekend.
If the movies filming now get done.
Oh, no. I think what's going to happen is it's going to be 2021 is going to be 2020. And then we're going to go from that forward. I mean,
I think everything's just going to, I think it's going to be more of a shift than seeing everything squeezed.
Mission Impossible.
Because now even like, like we just learned before we started recording, like Spider-Man 3, which hasn't even started production yet, that production's already being pushed back because of everything. So like productions that were in the middle of shooting have now been split.
Right.
Like they're not going back to Hawaii to shoot Jurassic Park anytime soon.
Right.
Yeah. So like these movies, especially movies that were going to require a lot of special effects, they're not going to get done in time.
Also, reshoots are interesting. Nolan could have had scheduled reshoots in April. You know what I mean?
Like reshoots. But reshoots are everything that he needs in the moment, and that's it. He gets it.
I agree with you.
You rewrite the Bible?
Reshoots aren't, in my opinion, an indication of a bad movie. I think that a lot of filmmakers do it. But I mean, I do wonder if reshoots are playing into this. Like if Nolan can't reshoot, what if Pattinson flubbed the line or something like that? He didn't know it.
I actually heard Nolan doesn't edit. It's all in camera. It takes him 2 hours.
He 1917's that bitch.
All right, this week in movies, we're going to move on to over on Hulu, a movie that Gabe adores, and I almost want him to turn his microphone on to defend it because have you guys seen Portrait of a Lady on Fire? Did either of you guys watch Portrait of a Lady on Fire?
Well, after your glowing endorsement on Twitter,
I watched it during the awards season. I watched it on a screener and I didn't think it was anything. I thought it was fine. I thought it was good. It's just, it was very, very slow to me.
You know, super meta would be to watch the movie in a portrait
while on fire,
like somehow put a screen while there's a fire.
There's a fire going on. But I will say that I am in the complete minority on this film. I mean, people who see it say that it's like the greatest movie to ever hit them. So I'm going to throw it out and say that it's on Hulu. Last week after recorded it, Gabe, can you weigh in on this? Or
yeah, I can weigh in. I'm recording.
Oh, good. Hey, nice.
We can only get Gabe to talk if it's about a subject he wants
this
to
talk. This is fair.
About.
I mean, this is true. Everything else, I care about none of this.
Tell all the blenders then why they should see Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
I think it's magnificent. It is slow. I totally get it. I went with a friend of mine who felt the same way you did, Sean, who thought it was really slow. He was like, I get that it's a good, like, well-made movie, but it didn't hit him the way that I was like, I left the theater just glowing. And so I get that. And I think it is slow. And I don't know what it is that you need to have or go in there, what sort of preconceptions you need to have going in there to love it. But for me, what I love about it is it's a French film and it's done in a really French way in that it is super visually rich. Like, it's the way that it's...
It's beautifully shot.
It, yes. Not only is it gorgeous, but the storytelling within the way that, like, they'll juxtapose two characters or frame things or shoot things so that they look... They suggest some sort of something else. And not just symbolism, but very much metaphorical in the way that, like, it composes its imagery, which is not a big American filmmaking style across the board. It's an indie filmmaking style in a lot of ways. So for me, as someone who has kind of a photography background and a cinematography background, I was just like reeling from some of the suggestions that like the story was making without even saying anything. So if you like visual storytelling, if you like sort of like breaking down cinematography or visuals, it is absolutely gorgeous. The story is great. I think it's a really unique kind of story. It's like, if you want to sit down and experience desire in like the most like pure form, it's really intense in that sense. But yeah, I love it. I don't know that it's for everyone, but I absolutely loved it.
I'll watch it based on what you just said. Sounds like a movie I'd love.
I'd love to hear what you guys think. Yeah, yeah. I love that movie.
Well, you're all in quarantine, so check it out and come back with your reactions to Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Also, coming to Hulu TV, we're talking about television shows and things that we're catching up on. Future Man, season 3 is coming to Hulu. Anyone here watching Future Man? Anyone on board with Future Man? Okay, check it out. Coffee and Kareem, Taraji P. Henson and Ed Helms is coming to Netflix. I don't know what that is. Do we know what that is? That's Gabe also? Gabe, nope. You're putting all your recommendations in here. No, it's just something that's coming. Tales from the Loops.
Ozark. Do you guys watch Ozark?
No, we didn't see Ozark. What is Ozark? Or Ozark season 3. How is it? I know what Ozark is. Oh, yes.
It's so good, dude.
Is it?
Oh, I'm it's the best season of the show so far. I'm on episode 7.
Okay.
Because after I finished season 3 of Better Call Saul, I took your advice and took a break to let it really kind of marinate, especially after what happens at the end of season 3. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to enjoy Tiger King. And, well, that didn't last long because I plowed through all 7 episodes. And so now I am 7 deep into Ozark, and then I'm going to go back to Better Call Saul.
Yeah, gotcha. I'm on episode 6 of Tiger King, and I'm on like episode 15 of season 1 of Lost, which is great.
Yeah,
that's where I'm catching up. And we should probably mention, I know these aren't in the movies of the week, but VOD, as we're recording this today specifically, Sonic hits VOD and Bad Boys for Life. So if you are looking for something to watch on VOD, but those are available now.
Can we also mention, can we plug the, we're gonna have a bonus episode. We're gonna have a bonus episode this week because we got Ben Schwartz, the voice of Sonic and a comedian that you know from several other projects, called into the show. And we were able to get him on for an episode that was going to be an interview that we were going to include in one of our regular episodes until it just ballooned into a tremendous conversation that went almost an hour and a half. So instead of trying to shoehorn it into a normal episode, we want to let it breathe and be its own thing. So we're going to have that later this week. You guys are Here's getting this episode now.
I'll give a tease, though. This is the first interview we've ever done where the person we were talking to got up to change their laundry during the actual interview.
Yes.
In the coolest way possible.
And he taught us a fun game, which you'll get to hear all of us play. So that's coming up later this week. So you'll have 2 Real Blend episodes coming to you. To faithful blenders by the end of the week to keep you all busy while you're staying safe.
Even the unfaithful ones, indoors. You can have them too.
Yes, the unfaithful ones can have them also. Which brings us to our blend game, which this week brought together superstars Ben Stiller and Edgar Wright. Two people who, I don't know if they're friends or not, but decided that in the middle of our needle drop blend, because Kevin was smart enough to tag Ben Stiller in his example, which was a Walter Mitty example, Ben Stiller decided to weigh in and praise Edgar Wright, to which Edgar Wright then dropped Ben Stiller a personal note and then hijacked our Twitter thread to tell everybody how much he enjoyed Ben Stiller's work in, what was that miniseries that Ben did?
Escape of Danamora, which is an amazing.
Right. You said is amazing, right?
Oh my God, that show is, I know Gabe watched it. There's a Del Toro, oh he didn't. There's a Gabe, there's a Del Toro delivery line in that show where he says, "Don't tell anybody," which is just shivering. It's unbelievable.
Benicio, right? Not
Benicio
Guillermo.
Del Toro. Yeah, Benicio. Yep.
I just want to see Guillermo in there. So needle drop blend. Kevin, you get to go first. So this is a use of an existing song in a movie so that we believe the way that we can sort of set it up, we're picking our favorite use of music in a song that either developed a character, moved a scene along, theoretically should be so inseparable from the scene itself that every time you hear the song, you're instantly transported to that scene.
What a great way to describe it.
Thank you. It's almost like I co-host a podcast on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
Kevin, you get to go
first.
Do
we have three different ones? Oh, yes! This is a hard one.
I was questioning my pick on this, and I was going back and forth in my mind, and then the way Sean just explained it, meaning that the scene itself is completely inseparable from the song, now completely solidified my...
Oh, can I guess yours?
Yeah.
Is it Stuck in the Middle with You?
Yeah, it has to be.
I knew it.
Only because it is... Okay, so, I mean, Reservoir Dogs is something I was obsessed with for a long time. I had the Mr. White poster in my room when I was in high school. You shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize. I was just... But there was a time period when, I've mentioned this in the show before, where they released the 15th anniversary edition and they had different colors for each release. And I remember on that particular DVD release, they had the first time that I'd ever seen it. I was so excited. Well, I shouldn't have been excited to see this because it's disgusting, but I was interested to know what it was going to be like. Tarantino was going to give you another angle of the ear being cut off. In the special features, he gave you the angle that you could actually see it happening. Because in the movie, Quentin, pans away from the ear being cut off, which in my opinion is way more terrifying, which is the same reason why Seven is so brilliant, because the violence is not really on camera. It's the aftermath or the discussion of it. And I think that that's a much more powerful way to display violence, especially in something that graphic in a scene like that. But I remember getting that DVD and watching that scene. It's a really bad cut, by the way. Like, the ear looks super fake. It looks really bad. But it was interesting to see Michael Madsen take off a fake ear from Marvin Nash's ear.
It's so him talking into the ear when he talks into the cut off ear.
Yeah,
it's disturbing.
But that scene is interesting, and I think the way Sean described it is the best way to put it. That scene does not work without that song. Now, listen, you can make an argument all day long. Yes, I've never seen the scene without that song. I never saw a different version of it, but it's those two married elements of soundtrack and score that Tarantino just does so masterfully and so magically in his movies that they become one. I feel like when you're watching a film, a lot of times there's a soundtrack song that hits and you start to wonder, oh, I know that song. You're pulled out of the movie. And they're two separate experiences now. The song is playing them, like old school, for example, when Metallica Master of Puppets comes on or whatever, when they're picking up when they're going to get the pledges or whatever. I wouldn't consider that to be an inseparable song from the scene, but it added to it. But like, I guess that's a random one to go to in my mind. But I think that Reservoir Dogs, that scene alone, it is the moment that reveals who Mr. Blonde is, though, also.
Yeah.
So Mr. Blonde, Michael Madsen's character has been kind of just, right? He's been sitting in the corner, back area of the warehouse, you know, smoking a cigarette or whatever he's doing. He's always been, I guess, I think until that point, super low key. He's also the one, I think we know at this point, right, that he's the one who went off with the gun during the robbery. I think Buscemi and Keitel already had the discussion about that in the side room while Roth was bleeding out, I'm pretty sure.
You're asking us?
No.
How many times have you seen this?
I already know it's the case. I'm just kind of covering my own butt to make sure my timeline's right. So you can tell I know the movie, obviously. So in that scene, it's when he goes over to the radio, and it's the turn of it. It's the sound of the radio dial moving between stations and then finding the announcer. I think it's Stephen Wright, right? Who's doing the voice.
Oh, right.
Of the
Yeah. But what, did Quentin Superstar say that he wanted a different song? Did Quentin want a different song in that scene, or was it always Stuck in the Middle? I forget. For some reason, it just hit me that I thought he wanted a different one.
I'm not sure.
I feel
sure.
like that happens a lot, right? Yeah. Where like they can't get the song that they want, and then they end up.
Yeah. But like,
well, either
like
way,
with Breakfast Club.
It's inseparable now.
But Stephen Wright saying like, "Hey, Billy, Super Sounds of the 70s, Steeler's Wheel," which it's funny, for many, many years, I thought that was a Bob Dylan song. I didn't know it was. And even though they say Steeler's Wheel in the movie, I never computed it. I always thought maybe the song was called Steeler's Wheel. I didn't know that song prior to That's Reservoir funny. Dogs. So that was a new experience when I first saw the movie in high school. But it's the way that Michael Madsen dances in that scene with the song playing that speaks to who he is as a disgusting murderer, right? Mm. So and Tarantino always does this really interesting thing where he takes violence and he makes it entertaining in a very disturbing way, but you're entertained by it. Like when you watch Pulp Fiction, you're entertained when Samuel L. Jackson is going off in the Ezekiel 25:17. It's an entertaining piece of dialogue, even though he's committing a horrible act. But there's something, and I don't think any of you guys would disagree with me, there's something weirdly entertaining about watching Madsen dance to that track. Even though it's a horrifying character, you are, as an audience member, entertained by it. And I don't think wrong to say.
Yeah, so, that's fair.
And it's a movie, it's fiction, obviously. But I think that that song really is the moment where Blonde comes out. And that's the person we know who he is. And it's a song that he clearly likes, that he's listened to in his own time. And I've actually never, ever, ever gotten into this much detail about this before. And now that I'm talking about it with you guys, new things are popping in my head. Think about it this way. Think about his character at home, driving on a radio, listening to that song prior to that scene.
Oh, like, think about him.
Think about Michael Madsen's character in his daily life, going to pick up tacos or something like that and coming home, feeding his dog, singing Steeler's Wheel to himself. Like, he clearly knows the song. He knows the lyrics. It's something that gives us an insight. How
about hearing it after the fact? Will he even think about the ear, or will he?
Right.
Is he just so psychotic that it doesn't register?
Well, that doesn't register. Well, he's dead. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah. He dies.
Which, by the way, I spent so much time in high school watching that shootout scene at the end to see who actually gets hit. Because I always wondered who and why Pink didn't get clipped in that scene, right? Because Pink is in that, Buscemi.
Stop pointing that gun at my dad!
Right. So, like, oh God, the way Chris Penn delivers that line is unbelievable. But anyway, so I'm going off on a tangent because a lot of things came up in my head while I was talking about it. But it's these games that really kind of start to make you really understand why you love something. And I think we, all of us, would agree. We all know we love things in movies, but sometimes we don't know why.
Yeah.
And I've, to this day, to this moment on this show right now, I never thought about Michael Madsen's character at home or somewhere else learning and listening to that song to apply it in that scene. And that's interesting. That I thought about now. So that's that is definitely my favorite needle drop example. But it is a very horrifying scene, so I'm not, you know, condoning it.
Kevin,
but,
you know, do you happen to know Mr. Blonde's favorite Frankie Muniz sitcom?
Oh wow.
Mr. Blonde has a Frankie Muniz sitcom.
Malcolm in the Middle with
Malcolm in the Middle with You? Hell yeah.
Stuck in the Malcolm in the Middle with You?
I like Malcolm in the Middle.
Come on. All right. I get to go next. And mine is going to contradict what we were saying about this, in that I think you can hear the song and it won't necessarily make you think of this movie instantly. But to me, it was the use of the song in the scene that totally elevated what was happening. And I'll give you guys a hint. It involves John Cusack, but it's not Say Anything. No, it's not the boombox and Say Anything.
Better Off Dead.
No, it's in Gross Point Blank. Oh. There's a moment when he's at the reunion. The whole point of Better Off Gross Point Blank, now you got Better Off Dead. The whole point of Gross Point Blank is that he's an assassin who's going back to his hometown for his high school reunion. He's facing all sorts of existential dread about even wanting to go back because he's kind of this isolated loner who makes a living killing people. It's a seriously dark comedy. He rekindles a romance with Minnie Driver, this girl that he's been in love with. He's trying to figure out what he's doing with his life. He's totally judging the people around him. And when he gets to a point during the reunion where he meets this lady who has a baby, and she kind of cuts through all of his nonsense, like in a really sharp way of saying, like, you know, you end up having a kid and all these things that you're thinking about, they don't matter anymore. They all get stripped away. And he stares into the baby's eyes. And the greatest, what I actually consider to be the greatest song ever written, which is Under Pressure, by David Bowie and Queen, soars up underneath. And it's been playing underneath. You didn't even necessarily realize it until he looks into this baby's eyes. And the music swells and David Bowie comes crashing in. And it's just the perfect moment of like self-realization for this character, that everything he's been fretting about through the course of the entire movie means nothing. And it like wipes away everything that he's been dealing with and centers him in a way that just was what the movie was building itself to. It was the perfect choice of song for that moment. And it almost gets even funnier because then he goes out into the hallway with this new sense of awareness and gets attacked by the assassin who's been tracking him around town the entire time. And they have to have a huge fight in the hallway. So it's the way that that movie sort of shifts gears so effortlessly. And Cusack gets a lot of credit, I think, for having a number of really great musical moments in his films. Obviously, Say Anything being one of them. High Fidelity has a number of excellent musical moments, too. I think that music is really important to him when he's making films, and probably with Cameron Crowe also, too. But Gross Point Blank, to me, has one of the most memorable soundtracks. But that moment, using Under Pressure, which I just think is probably the best song ever written and used in that scene, that is the Needle Drop Blend pick for me. And it's a little offbeat.
Good one.
But if you've seen it, you might recognize it as something that really, really works. The other one I have to give a quick shout out to before I throw it to Jake. This is one I honestly wanted to go with.
If you say mine, I'm going to be so pissed.
I don't think I'm going to. Mine is Backstreet Boys in the end credits for This Is the End, when they go up to heaven and Jay is able to say, they said, Jay, you can think of anything you want. And he thinks, and then the Backstreet Boys show up and they play Backstreet's Back.
That's a really great one. I love that movie, actually.
I swear to God, dude, I will always remember, I'm actually getting goosebumps thinking about it. When that scene happened in our packed preview house, it was like being at a concert. Like everybody was so hyped for that cameo, that we all felt like we were at a Backstreet Boys concert. Because it's really funny. You hear them start singing it. You see all of them come out. By the end, the cast is involved.
You see the hand go
off
first.
Yes, you see the hand go up and make the sign. And that I watched that soon today on YouTube. It was hysterical.
At what point can we all admit that I Want It That Way is an absolute masterpiece?
Oh, I'll say it right now.
I like 90s boy band.
I think the
masterpiece.
I think I've disturbed Michelle in that I listen to a lot of Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, things like that. Yeah, that's just catchy. It's catchy music.
I love One Direction. I love the new Harry Styles album. I'm all in.
There's
man.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah, no hate.
Harry Styles' albums are unbelievable. You guys would be surprised. They're very Bowie-esque.
I haven't really listened to
just because he's in Dunkirk. Stop it.
No, trust me,
Jake. All right, so Jake, what did you think I was going to say?
So mine actually falls more so into your realm, Sean, where people can absolutely hear this song and not think of the movie. I don't. I hear this song and I think of the movie, but I think that the song elevates the moment to one of my all-time favorite movie moments ever, and it is when Tiny Dancer kicks in and Almost Famous.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
Because it starts out in the movie, because Wayne was drugged out of his mind and they're pulling him out. You know, he had the big fight with the band and they're pulling him, you know, back to the bus and, you know, they're leaving the kids. And so, you know, the initial notes of Elton John start playing, and then they all get on the bus and they're all just pissed at each other and they're not talking to each other. And then slowly the drummer just kind of starts drumming the beat, and then one person starts singing and the other one starts singing. And then slowly the whole bus starts singing together. And I think one of the things I really like about that moment is because it is about the music. It's about the fact that like that song was sort of this great equalizer that kind of brought them all back. Like they all hated each other in that moment, but then they used music as a reminder of like, guys, this is why we're here. Mm-hmm. Like this is why we're doing this. Like it's fine. What happened. And that is one of my, like, you know, I know we've done Scene Blend and I chose the Transformers Rex Breakout and Jurassic Park, but number two, a very close number two, is the bus scene from Almost Famous. I think that
it's such a great
just
movie.
That's one of my all time favorite movies. That's one of the all time. I thought about doing the moment that I call it the Pulp Fiction theme. I know that's not what it's called, but like
when
she freezes and then the Pulp Fiction theme comes in. Yeah. But then my thought is like, then it just goes to credits.
Yeah,
and it's just this the song play. Like, so like it's not really like. Doesn't really add anything to like the scene because it's just like you know, that, but, so that's why I chose not to go with that. But yeah, so
it's funny. You could do, I thought about, Say Anything in Your Eyes. Mm-hmm. I thought about, Freebird from Elizabethtown, which I, where the sprinkler systems are going off and the band is still playing.
So Jerry Maguire.
I thought about Secret Garden from Jerry Maguire, or Free Fallin' from Jerry Maguire. Cameron Crowe and his needle drops are outstanding.
Yeah.
He's up there with who I'm going to mention here now too, Edgar Wright, because Ben Stiller, comedian, director extraordinaire Ben Stiller, played along with the Blend Game this week, much like Jessica Chastain did the previous week. He chose, Ben Stiller chose all of Baby Driver, as he said, is one big amazing needle drop sequence. Never have seen anything like it. Lens on Film chose Mad World from Donnie Darko, which is another really great use of that song.
That's a great
at the
one.
End of that movie. Carrie Case went with Tiny Dancer in Almost Famous as well, too. She's a huge Cameron Crowe fan as well. Rachel Bowen chose the Immigrant Song used in Taika Waititi's Thor Ragnarok, Kevin's favorite MCU film.
That's a great one.
Just a really great use of that song.
Did you guys ever see someone recutting that scene from an Infinity War? And it would have been so badass whenever Thor jumps in, lands back in Wakanda, but they put Infinity War. Like, it really makes me wish they had done that, because it would have been such a great callback.
Yeah.
I mean, I sort of get why they didn't, because, like, it takes, you know.
It's but pretty that, great,
like,
though.
If he had landed to Infinity War, or no, if he landed to Immigrant Song,
I'll take Sylvester over that any day, though. Just that
Sylvester's Avengers score.
Yeah, but you don't like Ragnarok.
It's fine.
How do you like Ragnarok? No, you like Iron Man 2 more than Ragnarok.
No, Ant-Man.
No, Iron Man 3.
Iron Man 3 is way better than Ragnarok, though. I mean, in my opinion.
Ah.
I love Iron Man 3, though. I thought Iron Man 3 was underrated.
Next week, we have reached the 2000s in our hashtag underrated 2000s blend. Ooh. So we're going decade by decade, and we're picking titles in that decade that we think don't get enough love. So give some attention to underrated 2000s blend, and you can play along on social media, or you can send us your pick via realblend@cinemablend.com. A fair share of people now sending us emails, which I think is really cool. Not just their picks for the blend game. God, where did my brain go? But reviews also, and that's what we're up to right now. Art Mart 21 from Canada says, great informative podcast. Well, hello, Art Mart, and we're sorry. Quentin Tarantino is my favorite director, he says. Great interview. I'm writing my scripts and planning on shooting my first feature. You guys bring a lot to the table. I'm happy I found your podcast. I have scripts in a few genres. I'm sure that there are quite a few inspiring filmmakers listening to your podcast. What I would like to hear from you guys is individual views on each genre. Short and sweet summary on what as a definition, a genre that you choose to discuss is, and what each of you is looking for, and what you think brings the audience to watch movies in that genre, sort of nuts and bolts. So if you guys could pick a different genre for each podcast, that would be great. A bit of a film school bite in each episode. Great job. So I just want to point out to Art Martin, and I don't know the numbers of the past episodes, but we definitely have done specific genres for the blend game. We did westerns. I know we've done film noir, and we did romantic comedies. So you can go back through some of our past episodes and I think get a pretty good insight into our choices. And then I think we're bringing conversations like this about different genres to the show on a regular basis. But thank you so much for that feedback. That's a really great review and a good thing for us to settle on going forward. Okay, again, I want to plug that this is not the only episode of Real Blend that you're going to be getting this week. We will have our bonus episode, a free-flowing conversation with the great Ben Schwartz, who came on to primarily talk about Sonic, which is coming to digital this week. Again, shortening that release window between theater and home video. But then he got into so many other really great stories about his career and things that he's been involved in, and we had a lot of fun with him. So that will be out before the end of the week is up. You guys can double your Real Blend fix on social media. You can follow the guys at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell. Drop us a review on iTunes or send it to us an email. We will read it at the top of the show. And again, we'll be back before next week with a bonus episode. Boys, anything to say before we wrap it up for another quarantine episode?
Tenet.
Can that be the new ending?
Next year.
don't do that to Kevin, please. That's the only thing that's holding out for him.
Literally.
That's the only thing I'm
living for.
Well, until then.
You know he has a wife, right?
Until that happens. Dunkirk.
Shark is the villain.
No, he's not. The mayor is the villain.
It shows over.
The mayor let people
go
back
home.
In the water.
I'm not listening. I gotta go.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.